Our discussion today is entitled Regiment of the Damned, the Ultimate Militia, 10th Regiment at the Mountain Meadows and its aftermath. The massacre produced dissolution in the 10th Regiment Iron County Militiamen. About 20 years after the massacre, the 10th Regiment had a force reunion occasioned by the trial of John D. Lee. This paper explores fractures in the regiment on three separate lines. One, the nine militiamen under indictment for murder. Two, the group of young militiamen who remained in Mormonism but who testified against their former militia leaders. And three, the group of militiamen whose disillusionment was so great that they testified at the Lee trials as ex-Mormons and even non-Mormons. Our presenter today is Robert H. Briggs, who has a law degree from Pepperdine, is a local civil attorney in Fullerton, and a Mormon History Association activist, and he'll explain that to us here in a second. We'll go for a period of time and have some time at the end for questions and answers, since we do not have a respondent. Robert.
It's nice to be here today. I looked down at the part that said MHA activist. I wrote in my little biographical sketch that I wrote in, I said that I had been active in MHA, and that turned into MHA activist, so I'm going to try to live up to that bill today, although I have no idea what that means. Mr. Mayfield said that he was the publicist for MHA. He also said he didn't know what that meant either, but in the spirit of full disclosure, my great-great-grandfather was Samuel Knight, who was one of the men that was at the Mountain Meadows Massacre. One of my interests on this subject is to try to put a human face on all of the people that were involved in the massacre, whether they be Paiute Indians or Arkansas immigrants or Mormon militiamen. And so another thing that prompted me to take on this particular topic was the fact that I think that Dudley Levitt and his 52 or 56 children, Dudley Levitt was also at the massacre, probably has at least 10,000 descendants today. I think John D. Lee probably has the same number of descendants. And when you multiply that by the roughly 50 to 100 men that had some involvement, there's probably at least 200,000 to 300,000 descendants of these men, and perhaps some of us would like to know what it was that our grandfathers were doing there. And this is a preliminary, and I emphasize preliminary, attempt to deal with this subject. My subject is the Utah Militia's 10th Regiment, or Iron Military District, during and after the period of the so-called Utah War. As is well known, officers and militiamen of this regiment were involved in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. This is a preliminary effort to identify who were those involved in the massacre, what military rank did they hold, what general role did they play, and what impact did the subsequent conflict over the massacre have on the members of the regiment. Wrapped within these seemingly simple questions are difficult issues involving conflicting sources, questionable sources, and once extant sources not presently available. Thus, a major concern for me was to find reliable and, where possible, verifiable data. Despite these obstacles, however, as I proceeded, I found the approach had promise, and this raised yet another question, one which for me is the most intriguing of all. By investigating the military character, and that's in contrast to the religious character, by investigating the military character of the groupings of men who planned, implemented, and executed the actions leading to the Mountain Meadows Massacre, what insights will it yield about this tragic event? And then in this first section, I lay out some background information about the settlement of Cedar City, that area in 1851. The Iron Mission that was established there, the coming of the Southern Indian Mission, a different mission in 1854, the fact that there was, in the early days, there was a lot of flux between organizations. They did not have the kind of strict, rigid organization back then that we think of in the church today. So there was conflict on organizational lines between those in the Iron Mission and those in the Indian Mission. Two of the leading antagonists in that group, one was John D. Lee, who was one of the old settlers in southern Utah, saw himself as having a leadership position over the Indian missionaries. His counter-antagonist was Thomas D. Brown, who was the secretary of the Indian Mission. And if you've an excellent source for this is Juanita Brooks' edited version of Brown's journal, which talks about this conflict in particular between John D. Lee and Thomas Brown, where it got down to the point where there was some mutual spying going on between the two different camps or cliques. And Brown considered Lee to be a tyrant, while Lee considered Brown to be an apostate. Yet, by early 1857, T.D. Brown had departed for northern Utah. John D. Lee had been appointed Indian farmer, and there is evidence that he and the Indian missionaries, now relocated to Fort Clara on the Santa Clara Stream, were working together with some degree of cooperation. Thus, by 1857, matters were reasonably patched up. Also by 1857, a loose militia organization existed in southern Utah, and all able-bodied men were de facto members. The Iron Military District was drawn from the original communities of Parowan and Cedar City, plus the small fort settlements of Fort Johnson, Fort Hamilton, Fort Harmony, and Fort Clara. Finally, the men of the new community of Washington, situated near the banks of the Virgin River, were also members. The 1857 militia rolls of the Iron Military District reflect that 450 men were enlisted in 4 battalions, 9 companies, and 45 platoons, all within the 10th Regiment. The regimental command consisted of Colonel William H. Dame, his adjutant or assistant, James H. Martineau, the regimental surgeon, Calvin Pendleton, and the fifer, James H. Haslam. Of the 4 battalions, the first was in Parowan, commanded by Major James Lewis. 2 others were in Cedar City, commanded by Majors Isaac C. Haight and John M. Higby, respectively, and the last was in Fort Harmony, commanded by Major John D. Lee. There were a total of this 450. There were a total of 316 privates, about 70% in the regiment, while the leader corps, above the level of platoon, exclusive of drummers and fifers, consisted of 30 men. These were William H. Dame and his staff that I've just mentioned, the majors and their adjutants over the 4 battalions, and the captains and their adjutants over the 9 companies. The June 1857 muster rolls reflect the basic structure of the regiment, although obviously in a frontier setting, it could not be considered well-equipped, well-drilled, or well-prepared. And then we get to the time of the commencement of the Utah War, which was in the summer of 1857. The word in northern Utah, it took about 2 weeks for written notice. And one of the things we got to remember is the difficulty of communications in those times. You know, I can send Amin an email, and he can get it, like a couple of seconds later. In those days, we have to remember that any communication was a man on a horse. That's how they got the message through. So it took about 2 weeks for written word to get from northern Utah down to southern Utah. And then George A. Smith was the apostle who shepherded the southern territory. He came down. He made a tour. He took with him various of the military officers, Dame Martineau, Pendleton, Davies, John D. Lee, and some others. And while he would preach and prepare the people, the militia personnel would gather the troops and drill them and prepare them. Now, there were some rumors of approaching troops both from the east and from the west, but these rumors later were shown to be false. Nonetheless, they brought them, the militia, to a heightened state of readiness and alert. Into this tinderbox rolled a train of West Arkansas immigrants. And as you know, they passed through Cedar City. They were on the California Road. They went down by Pinto and down to the meadow or the grassland of the Mountain Meadows where they encamped. They were initially attacked on Monday, September 7. They were besieged for 5 days. On Friday, September 11, they were deceived into abandoning the protection of their Wagon Circle Fort. Approximately 120 were killed and 17 small children survived. The details of the Mountain Meadow tragedy have been told elsewhere. Let us turn to our first question. Who was there? And then I describe briefly how word first leaked to Southern California. There was a train, an immigrant. Actually, it wasn't an immigrant train. The Duke Tanner train was behind the Baker Fancher train, and as they made it to Southern California, they brought word of this massacre of 120 Arkansas immigrants, allegedly by Indians. But they also brought with them the first suspicion that there was white involvement, and John D. Lee's name was mentioned from the very beginning. I don't know why. I don't know what the source would have been. Was it because he was the Indian farmer in the Southern Territory and had responsibility for the Paiutes? That may have been it. There may have been something else. But at any rate, John D. Lee's name was mentioned in the California papers, and within 2.5 months, those reports had gotten to the East Coast and were published in the New York Daily Times on November 30, 1857. Thus, within 2.5 months, the story had spread first to the West Coast, then to the East. Now we get to the first period of federal investigation, which were the years of 1857 to 59, particularly in 58 and 59. And there were a number of things. Garland Hunt was the first Indian Indian agent, and then Jacob Forney came after him. Forney did some investigation, and in 1859 he published or circulated a list of 7 individuals whom he considered the most guilty. They included Major Isaac C. Haight, Major John M. Higbee, Major John D. Lee, Adjutant W.R. Davies, whom he listed as Bishop Davis, Private and also Bishop Philip Klingensmith, Private David Tullis, and Private Ira Hatch. Well, there's other investigations. There was a Captain Campbell. James Lynch provided an affidavit. Most of us are familiar with Major Carlton and his investigation, which is very interesting. But let's go to Judge John Cradlebaugh's investigation. He did a reasonably extensive investigation in southern Utah. And in the report he later prepared, he listed 8 sources. Two of them were various groups of Indians. Another were apostate Mormons in Cedar City. There were some, quote, some engaged in the massacre, close quote, also from Cedar. 3 or 4 surviving children. One particular surviving children, a child who he gave the pseudonym of John Calvin Sorrow. An unknown and unidentified militia informant. And finally, Sergeant Henry Higgins of the militia. The affidavit of Sergeant Henry Higgins of the 5th Platoon, Company F of Major Higbee's 3rd Battalion was a coup. It was the first written statement from a Mormon source regarding any aspect of the massacre. Moreover, it was from an Iowa County militiaman, albeit one who was not present at the massacre. In his affidavit, Sergeant Higgins estimated that that a unit of about 25 had left Cedar City. He also provided the names of Major Higbee, Second Lieutenants Curtis and Stewart, and Sergeants Pollock, Bateman, and Loveridge as among those present. In addition, he identified 10 or 12 new wagons and oxen which had returned with plunder to Cedar City, and these items were later sold at the tithing office. This affidavit raises a host of questions about Sergeant Higgins, none of which I can answer at the present time. I'd really like to know a lot about this guy, but I guess it'll just have to wait. Yet, despite its details, Sergeant Higgins' affidavit was not as valuable as the account of one other unidentified informant, one who had been present at the massacre itself. Describing this witness as, quote, tormented in mind and conscience, close quote, Deputy Marshal William Rogers stated that he provided the identities of 25 to 30 men involved in the massacre. Who was this mystery informant? According to Judge Cradlebaugh's list, 36 arrest warrants were issued. Examining the arrest warrant list provides at least one good clue. Recall that Indian agent Jacob Forney's list of the most guilty included 7 alleged principals, one of which was Bishop Philip Klingensmith of Cedar City. As the shroud over the massacre gradually lifted, Bishop Klingensmith's name always figured prominently. Yet while nearly every other name later connected conspicuously to the massacre is on the arrest warrant list, Bishop Klingensmith is not. Why? Judge Cradlebaugh was sitting in an unusual position of examining magistrate. That is, he was self-appointed to the role of investigating the massacre. The arrest warrants were issued to locate witnesses and accused alike to assist his investigation and anticipated criminal proceedings. But would an arrest warrant be necessary for Philip Klingensmith if he were already cooperating with Judge Cradlebaum? That, I suggest, is why Philip Klingensmith's name does not appear on the list of arrest warrants. While there may have been other militiamen who surreptitiously provided statements to the court in 1859, I hypothesize that Bishop Philip Klingensmith was a confidential informant to the Cradlebaum investigation. But whoever the mystery man was, based on statements from this and other informants, Judge Cradlebaugh issued 36 arrest warrants, which sent the militiamen of Cedar scattering. All of the arrest warrants were directed to members of the Iron Military District, or 10th Regiment, and all except one was attached to the 3 battalions located in Cedar City and Fort Harmony. Besides privates, the list of arrest warrants included 7 sergeants, 6 second lieutenants, 1 captain's adjutant, 3 captains, 1 major's adjutant, and 3 majors. Among the three battalions later connected in some fashion to the massacre, that represents 23% of the sergeants, 19% of the second lieutenants, 50% of the captains, and 100% of the majors. Clearly, the leadership of these three battalions was being targeted. Further, the most damaging information was coming from informants within the 10th Regiment itself. Thus, despite the solemn vows of secrecy reportedly taken by these units after the massacre, within 2 years the solidarity of the 10th Regiment was beginning to crack. And then the Civil War comes, or threats of the Civil War, and these federal officials and their investigation came to a screeching halt, and nothing happened on the federal level for the next 10 years, over 10 years. And the next thing that happened was the affidavit of Philip Klingensmith in 1871, which I'm going to skip over, and I'm going to go to the next important thing, which was the formation of a federal district court in southern Utah, Jacob Borman as the judge, now with new power under the Poland Act, now with new jurisdiction, and he impaneled a grand jury, and the grand jury brought in 10 witnesses. The 10 witnesses testified before the grand jury impaneled by Jacob Borman. The witnesses included a Gentile traveler, Azahel Bennett, a Mormon freighter, E.C. Matthews, and an ex-Mormon traveler, Robert Keyes. There were another three, Charles Salmon, Henry Norris, and a Mr. Willis, whom I cannot yet identify, although the last named, Willis, may have been a 10th Regiment militiaman. There were six militiamen with the surname of Willis in the regiment, all within the battalions from Cedar or Fort Harmony. The remaining four grand jury witnesses were clearly militiamen. They were Private Robert Kershaw, Private William Roberts, Private John W. Bradshaw, and Private Robert Bullock. The first three named, Kershaw, Roberts, and Bradshaw, later testified in the first trial of John D. Lee. Thus, we have a reasonably good idea of the subject matter of their testimony before the grand jury. By 1875, Kershaw and Bradshaw were ex-Mormons and were identified as such in the Lee trial. Evidently, Roberts remained a Mormon. As to Bullock, I have no information on his religious leanings at that point. In summary, then, of the 10 witnesses to testify before the grand jury, at least four were Iron County militiamen, while at least three were ex-Mormons. And then out of that grand jury of 15 grand jurymen, none of whom were militiamen, came a criminal indictment for murder and conspiracy against nine members of the Iron Military District. Included in what we might term the Mountain Meadows Nine were Colonel William H. Dame, Regimental Commander, Major Isaac C. Hay, 2nd Battalion, Major John M. Higbee, 3rd Battalion, Major John D. Lee, 4th Battalion, 2nd Lieutenant William C. Stewart, Private and Bishop Philip Klingensmith, and then three privates, Elliot Wilden, George Adair Jr., and Samuel Jukes. Right, just Samuel Jukes. There are some strange things about this indictment. On the one hand, simply by virtue of their positions within the militia command, there were good reasons for the indictment against Colonel Dame and Majors Haight, Higbee, and Lee. In addition, based on evidence produced later, there appears to be good reasons for the indictments of Bishop Klingensmith and 2nd Lieutenant Stewart. But what about the three privates, Wilden, Adair, and Jukes? To me, that's a mystery. What had been the testimony before the grand jury that caused these three privates to be singled out and indicted? Was it a tactic employed by the prosecutors to encourage rank-and-file militiamen to turn state's evidence and testify against their superior officers? I don't know. I have not been able to find even the allegations against these three that caused them to be singled out by the grand jury and indicted. Then the next step is the first trial of John D. Lee, 1875, the official name of which was The People of the United States and Utah Territory versus William H. Dame et al. And the people elected to proceed to trial against, first, against defendant John D. Lee. As is well known, this trial ended in a hung jury. Less well known is that during the proceedings, 29 witnesses were called, including 21 10th Regiment militiamen. Of these, 13 testified during the prosecution's case against their former comrade in arms. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to read all of those names, but I have them broken down by that there were three from the 1st Battalion, five from Haight's 2nd Battalion, two from Major Higbee's 3rd Battalion, and three from Major Lee's 4th Battalion. And of them, there were five ex-Mormons to testify, three of which were militiamen. Then we have the witnesses that Lee put on, and Lee's attorneys called three of those that had three militiamen that had testified in the prosecution's case, and then he called eight others. And again, we have it looks like four from the 1st Battalion, three from the 3rd Battalion, and one from the 4th Battalion. And also of that makeup, two of those were bishops. There was Bishop Farnsworth from Beaver and Bishop Robinson from Pinto, I believe it was. So that's the first trial, ends in a hung jury. The second trial of John D. Lee. In the second Lee trial in 1876, the prosecution presented a more narrowly focused case. With the exception of Lieutenant General Daniel H. Wells, all witnesses came from within the ranks of the 10th Regiment. Returning as a prosecution witness from the first trial was Captain Joel White of Company D in Major Haight's 2nd Battalion. The other militia witnesses were from Major Haight's 2nd Battalion was 2nd Lieutenant Nephi Johnson, Sergeant William McMurdy, Private Laban Merrill, Private James Haslam, and then from Lee's 4th Battalion were two men who had been under him. And those two were 2nd Lieutenant Jacob Hamblin and Private Samuel Knight. All had been militiamen in the Iron Military District of 1857. In addition, all except Jacob Hamblin were present at the massacre. The jury in Lee's second trial returned its guilty verdict in September 1876. Thank you. The next month, Judge Borman sentenced Lee to death by hanging. After his appeal to the Utah Territorial Supreme Court was denied and his clemency request rejected, Lee's execution date was set for March 23, 1877. Thus, Lee had 6 months between sentencing and execution of sentence. Toward the end of this period, John D. Lee wrote feverishly. In addition to a variety of letters to his family, legal counsel, and others, Lee prepared a relatively short account of the massacre, which he delivered to prosecutor Sumner Howard about a month before his execution. Per their agreement, Howard held what has been termed the Lee-Howard Statement. Then shortly after the execution was carried out, delivered it to the Salt Lake Daily Tribune, which published it immediately. It was republished in many newspapers throughout the county. throughout the country. In addition, Lee prepared the manuscript of his autobiography, which he delivered to his legal counsel, William W. Bishop. Bishop perused Lee's manuscript and noted that Lee had provided the names of other militiamen whom Lee claimed were at the massacre. In a letter dated April 27, 1877, Bishop provided to U.S. Marshal William Nelson, which is sort of an interesting thing that you've got a defense attorney who is providing information to the U.S. Marshal, but that's what happened. Bishop provided to U.S. Marshal William Nelson a list of persons assisting in and present at the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Lee's posthumously entitled biography, The Confessions of John D. Lee, which is the shortened version of the title, was published by Bishop later that year. It contains Lee's most detailed account of the massacre, his confession, sometimes also called the Lee Bishop Statement. In addition, in chapter 24, it contains a list of assassins prepared by Bishop and nearly identical to the earlier list that he had provided to U.S. Marshal Nelson. Bishop listed 52 names, including John D. Lee, but by mistake he included a name not listed by Lee. In his confession, Lee identified 51 individuals, including himself. To his recollection, 54 whites were present and several hundred Paiute Indians. So now we can get to the point I've sort of summarized what all of that investigation was and how out of this a number of names began to be identified. And now, compiling information from all of these sources, our list of those at least in the valley of the Mountain Meadows, if not at the massacre itself, includes 11 men who were self-admitted participants. That is, that they admitted, they either testified to it, or they made some other written statement identifying themselves as having been present at the massacre. To those, we can add an additional 14 whose presence is confirmed from multiple sources. That gives us 25, in my view, that are rock solid. The evidence that they were present is, to my way of thinking, rock solid or nearly as close to that as you can get. In addition, there are 31 others who I believe are reasonably implicated, which gives us a total of 56. Now, Lee said there were 54, and I come up with 56. The reason is Lee and I guess, had two different questions. Lee was trying to answer the question, how many people were right there at the site, you know, smack dab in the middle of the valley where the massacre occurred. What I'm trying to do is look at the whole valley, and we come up with some additional names who may not have been there, but I'm trying to ask the question, well, who would have been a witness in some sense? If you were David Tullis and you were up at the north end of the valley near Jake Hamblin's shanty, which was about the only building up there, and Tullis was working for Hamblin at the time, in that 2-3 miles, Tullis could have heard gunshots, and so in that sense he's a witness to something going on, even though Tullis may not have been right there, Johnny, on the spot. So that comes up with 56, and then I give the ranks of those involved. There were, and I'm not going to name 56 names for you, but there were two majors, John Higbee and John D. Lee, two adjutants to the major, John M. McFarlane and John Urey. There were four captains, Edwards, Pierce, Tate, and White. And then we go on from there, one adjutant to captain, 10 lieutenants, 11 sergeants, and 26 privates. Okay, so that's who was in the valley, but obviously there had to be some other planning. There had to be other militia people who were involved in planning would not have been there. So what can we do to try and identify those? And so, again, going through all of the documents and trying to identify a military council and identify the individuals that were present at various military councils. And so on the Saturday, September 5, there was some activity in Cedar City. Isaac Haight and some councils there, and he counseled with Lee later that evening. On Sunday, there was a church council, which had a decidedly military flavor to it. Out of that, we get at least five people, and we can probably identify some more. On the Wednesday, let me read this on the Wednesday, 9 September 1857, 2 days before the Maine massacre. A military council meeting was held at Parowan late Wednesday night. Present at the meeting were Colonel Dame, Dame's adjutant, James H. Martineau, and his other staff member, Calvin Pendleton. Also present were Captain Jesse N. Smith, Private Elijah Newman, and Private Carlton Lewis from the vicinity of Parowan, and Major Haight and Captain Elias Morris from Cedar City. William Barton, a second lieutenant attached to one of the platoons in Company C, was on guard duty. He observed arrivals and departures, but did not hear the discussions. But it's from Elias Morris and William Barton that we get that information on that council meeting. And then, of course, Lee identifies a council meeting that took place on the grounds. So we come up with a certain number of people involved in military councils. And then this last group are the express riders. I'm going to take a minute or two to go through this because it sort of gives us the flavor of what it took to communicate in those days. So on 5 September, Saturday, Private Samuel Wood was directed to go from Cedar to Major Haight's home in Fort Harmony. Also, Captain Joel White, accompanied by Private Klingensmith, went from Cedar to Pinto. Then on Sunday, Second Lieutenant Don Carlos Schertz went from Fort Harmony to Washington and Fort Clara. His order was to raise the Indians. Sergeant Amos Thornton went to Pinto, not exactly sure why. Private Samuel Knight went from the Mountain Meadows to Fort Clara. His order also was to raise the Indians. On Monday, two express riders took off from Cedar City, one of them heading south to Pinto, and that was Joseph Clues. The other one, James H. Haslam, making his ride all the way to Salt Lake City, and his orders were to try and get some guidance from Governor Young. On Wednesday the 9th, Captain Eleazar Edwards, who was at the Meadows, or possibly Adair, took a message from the Mountain Meadows to Cedar. The question on that is because John D. Lee couldn't remember which of the two he ordered to take the express to Cedar. He thought it was probably Edwards, possibly Adair. Also, on the same day, Captain Jesse Smith and Second Lieutenant Edward Dalton took expresses from Parowan to Pinto. And then on the day of the massacre, Friday, 11 September 1857, but after the massacre, Captain Elias Morris, accompanied by Adjutant Christopher Arthur, arrived at the Mountain Meadows. Also, Second Lieutenant John Henry Willis, and each of these left from Cedar and drove the roughly 25, 30 miles to Mountain Meadows. Then on the Saturday, the day after, we've got Colonel William H. Dame, Major Lewis of the 1st Battalion, Major Haight of the 2nd Battalion, and Privates Barney Carter and Beeson Lewis, who accompanied Dame and went there to the to the site of the massacre. To recap then, within the confines of the valley known as the Mountain Meadows, there reasonably appears to have been present 56 members of the Iron Military District, adding 12 officers at council meetings in Parowan and Cedar, and 17 express riders, comes to 29 involved in the planning and or communications. However, a number of these men had multiple or overlapping roles. Thus, after controlling for the overlapping roles, we can be reasonably certain that at least 76, in other words, another 20 to add to our 56, at least 76 militiamen of various stripes were involved in one capacity or another. The federal investigators identified an additional 14 whom they suspected of complicity. There is less certainty about those of this group. Thus, it seems fair to say that there were from 76 to 90 members of the Iron Military District who had some firsthand knowledge of one or more aspects of the Mountain Meadow Massacre. The entire Iron Military District had 450 individuals on its muster roll. 76 to 90 militiamen we have identified as involved constitute between 16% and 20% of the total regiment. There may have been more. On the other hand, not all were present or even involved for the following reasons. One, the 1st Battalion in Parowan was not called up to the Mountain Meadows at all, although they were sent to Beaver to quell unrest between Paiutes and a later immigrant company. Second, they would naturally experience some attrition in turnout due to the non-professional nature of the units. Third, at least some were confirmed to be away on trips to Great Salt Lake City or elsewhere, and thus absent from Iron County. Fourth, it was the season for harvesting and thrashing grain, which was always a critical activity, but more so that season because Johnson's army was advancing on the territory. The Mountain Meadow Massacre produced dissension and even a crisis within the LDS Church in southern Utah. The lack of unity reflected the failure of certain primary religious goals. Less well recognized, however, is that the extent of dissension within the ranks of the 10th Regiment reflected a collapse of certain military goals as well. Among those goals, which crashed on the shoals of Mountain Meadows, were respect and deference to superior officers, unity, solidarity, and cohesiveness. This must have been devastating to the morale of the units within the 10th Regiment. One of the leading historians of the massacre, Juanita Brooks, preserves a sentiment expressed by her grandfather, Private Dudley Levitt of Fort Clara as of 1857 and himself present at the massacre. His advice to his children was that they should never marry a Dame, Hate, Higby, Lee, or a Klingensmith. In that kernel lies one of our strongest emotions, a sense of betrayal. A close associate of Private Dudley Levitt was Private Samuel Knight, likewise of Fort Clara. Nearly 40 years after the massacre, Knight was interviewed about his recollections of the massacre. His interviewer recorded Knight's account, including Knight's reaction to the arrival of the superior officers to the killing field in the hours after the massacre. Private Knight told how he, quote, learned that none of the general authorities of the church had sanctioned or encouraged in any way the dastardly deed of which these fanatics were guilty, close quote. Thus, for the privates and junior officers who remained within Mormonism, their sense of betrayal focused on the Iron County militia leadership, specifically Dame, Hate, Higby, Lee, and Klingensmith. For them, Mormonism's greatest and most harrowing disaster was due to their immediate military superiors. But for some others, the sense of betrayal was even more profound. It touched the core of their sense of self, and it shattered their Mormon worldview. I'm sure that this is only a partial list, but among those whose faith in the Mormon movement was ruined were Bishop of Cedar City and Private Philip Klingensmith, Private Robert Kershaw, Private John W. Bradshaw, Private Joseph Clues, Annie Elizabeth Hoag of Fort Harmony, who had been a witness in the trial, and that's how we know that, in the first trial, and probably Robert Keyes, who was the Mormon traveler from San Bernardino and who was identified as an ex-Mormon. And no doubt, for each one who made a complete break, there must have been others, perhaps many others, who remained yet were wounded by deep disillusionment. Can we imagine that any of them escaped harrowing dreams, nightly torments, the dark night of the soul, or in John Steinbeck's phrase, the specter of looking into the dark waters? Let me close with Nephi Johnson. In 1857, Nephi Johnson was a 24-year-old Indian missionary. Pursuant to orders from Major Haight, which resulted in Lee's conviction. Understandably, Johnson's testimony was more on John D. Lee and Lee's role rather than his own. But as the years went by, Johnson made additional statements, expanding in some ways on his trial testimony. He made an additional statement in the 1890s. An interview he gave in the 1890s was also preserved. And finally, in 1907, which is 50 years after the massacre, he made a final written statement. Three of these four recorded accounts are extant. To me, he seems to become more forthcoming as the years went by. In his later years, he lived in Bunkerville, Nevada, on the south side of the Virgin River. Occasionally, he would ask a young school teacher in town to drop by so he could have her record some events from his life. The young school teacher is later known to us as Mormon historian Juanita Brooks. However, as she later recalled, at that time she was more interested in young men than old men, and she did not drop by. The scene at Nephi Johnson's deathbed was far from placid. In his delirium, Johnson kept calling for the young school teacher, and he was tortured by these dreams and visions in which he would say blood, and kept repeating that. And the young school teacher arrived and couldn't figure out, you know, why this kindly old man who was the patriarch in Bunkerville, you know, why was this happening? And somebody finally said to her, well, don't you know he was at the Mountain Meadows Massacre? And that's the beginning of Juanita Brooks' involvement in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. This experience of Nephi Johnson on his deathbed is 50 years after the massacre, a half a century, and yet that was his experience. Paraphrasing, and this is my last paragraph, paraphrasing Richard Bushman, we are sometimes called upon to mourn the failures of men. I think he actually said the failures of the saints in God's great cause. And that's worth repeating. We are sometimes called upon to mourn the failure of the saints in God's great cause. This entire episode is one such profound case. It is the saddest tale in Mormonism. Yet out of profound tragedy may come some hard-earned wisdom. My hope is that from the lives of some of the unfortunate wretches in the Iron County 10th Regiment, we may yet find that wisdom. Thank you.
We have a few minutes left, and we do not have a respondent, so if anybody has any questions, I'm sure Robert will answer them for you here.
Okay. And for the tape, would you like to, you know, you can even come up and speak into this or have
fine,
him
yes.
repeat it. Go ahead, I'll turn it.
Okay. I still haven't been able to get my arms around the motivation of this attack to begin with. I've heard revenge because of, what happened in Arkansas with
Parley Pratt
and the fear of the war coming on. But I still, how much did, my understanding is that this party that was attacked was relatively wealthy party. I mean, they had a lot of wealth. Was part of it greed? Did you ever read, I mean, is part of it just flat out greed besides paranoia?
In the trial, the federal prosecutors developed that angle, and they brought out testimony to show that the materials that were collected at the Mountain Meadows were brought back, and of course it really looks bad. It was brought back. It was put into the tithing office in Cedar City. It was held there for a period of time. I guess during that time, it technically would have been under the supervision of Bishop Klingensmith. Then later there was some kind of an auction held in which the materials were auctioned off. At least one account says that Lee was the auctioneer. So there is some evidence of that. And also there is...
At least they didn't get it by winning the lottery.
Yeah, yeah. There's also at least one account that, and I'm a little fuzzy on this one, but of someone who said that he talked to, I believe it was Higby, and if you believe that account, then Higby said that part of the reason had to do with this company. Sometimes I think the wealth of that company is exaggerated. For instance, you sometimes hear accounts that say that it was the wealthiest company that had ever crossed, and I don't think that that was the case. But they had anywhere between 300 and 1,000 head of cattle, and that in and of itself, of course, was considerable wealth.
One of the families said there was $5,000 to $10,000 for the gold.
And the question now is about the account of $5,000 to $10,000 in gold. And yes, there is such an account. I don't know how to handle things like that. I don't know how you confirm or disconfirm, verify or not an account like that. Yes.
Robert, what specific action was ever taken against any of these individuals by the church? How many of them actually had any proceedings at the church court or whatever, and were later, say, rescinded also?
A year later, there was some kind of a church court held in Parowan against Dame, who by that time was a stake president in that area. And they held a court for about, as I recall, about 3 full days. And there is a summary of that which lists the allegations against him, none of which appear to have anything to do with Mountain Meadows. They're kind of peevish kinds of things, it appears to be. However, they start this on, I think it was on a Monday, and then in the middle of it, they call for a couple of other people to come, and they call in Isaac Haight from Cedar, they call in Nephi Johnson from around Cedar, they may have called in one or others who were there. Anyway, they go through about 3 or 4 days, and at the end, and I think one of the non-Mormons of the time made an astute comment about the Mormon judicial system, which was that they really did not have courts as we think of them, that the Mormons engaged in what he called arbitration. And I think that's probably a fair way to describe what happened. Was they got together all of these complaints and they basically arbitrated between them. And on this, and the result of this was, and you're probably aware of this, that the document, the later document produced at the end, which has the signatures of about 20 individuals that exonerate him from the charges. So Dame remains in his position. However, when Judge Cradlebaugh got to town to Cedar City in 1859 and issued these arrest warrants to about 36, and they just headed for the hills, literally, and that really disrupted the church. And so by around 1859, 1860, Haight no longer was the president of... There's another thing going on in Cedar City as well, and that is probably for two reasons, the failure of the Iron Mission as well as the Mount Meadows Massacre, and it's hard to separate those two. But anyway, those two events in Cedar City just caused people to leave. Economically, it wasn't working out, and the whole stigma of the massacre was so strong that a number of people left. So Cradlebaugh got into town and he found all kinds of vacant homes, and so he just took one of them, he rented it, and he set up his court in one of the vacant homes because there was that kind of vacancy. So at the end of that, Klingensmith and Haight no longer had their church positions. Why? I don't know for certain. Was it because of Mountain Meadows? Was it because they had to be on the lam because they were fugitives and it simply disrupted their ability to perform the office? I don't know. Let's see, and then in the early 70s, Lee was excommunicated. Also in the early 70s, and somebody may want to correct me if I'm off on this, Haight was excommunicated or disfellowshipped, and then I have in mind that he was brought back in, but I'm a little fuzzy on that. So that's as much as I can tell you. Yes?
The present Apostle Haight, his autobiography,
yes,
still claims John D. Lee, not his ancestor.
The comment is that the present Apostle Haight, in his autobiography, blames John D. Lee and not his ancestor, Isaac C. Haight. Thanks for the comment. Yes. Last comment.
And John D. Lee was reinstated in the 50s under President Kennedy.
That's true. That's true.
Just two quick comments. One is I was there last Sunday just by accident. And the date, interestingly enough, that President Hinckley dedicated the site was the same date of that week, and it was September 11th.
Right.
Number two is my mother's father was a grandson of Parley B. Pratt. My mother's mother was a granddaughter of John D. Lee. And she remembers her grandmother, and my mom's still alive. She remembers her grandmother, who was later adopted, remarried, different last name, saying, "Don't you ever tell anybody that my real name is Lee," you know, telling this deep, dark secret. So it's still, you know, we think ancient history, it's still alive today. It's pretty interesting.
Yes. Thank you very much. You know, I do have one other thing to add, and that is, very quickly, if any of you are interested, I would really like to follow up on family members. So if any of you have an interest in this and have a family connection, I really am trying to figure out the impact of this whole thing on the different people that were involved, such as the comment that was made at the end. Thanks.